Good morning, I'd like to get started. I'd like to welcome you to the end user opt-in working group meeting here at GEC4. My name is Harry Mussman. I'm the systems engineer from the GPO. This is our agenda for this morning. We'll have a brief welcome from the working group chairs who unfortunately cannot be here physically but are here via speakerphone. Then we'll have a talk from Matt Mathis of the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center on requirements for wholesale opt-in. It's things that he's worked out on his Spiral One project, and I think it's very, very interesting in the opt-in space. And another interesting opt-in related project is the MillionNode Genie project, and Justin Campos from the University of Washington is here to explain how they're getting that started and what's going on in that project. Lastly, I have a systems engineering report, sort of a view of what's going on in opt-in today and what's going forward. And we'll do a quick wrap-up and be done. Without further ado, I'd like to start with a welcome. And I think, Helen, you're on the line?
Yeah, can you hear me, Harry?
Yes, I think everybody can.
All right. That's mainly what I have to say. Welcome, everybody, to this meeting, to the opt-in meeting. I'm really sorry I couldn't be there. For those of you who don't know me or not familiar with my work, I'm actually a philosopher by training, and I've been working in the area of information technology and various social and political issues, including privacy and security and the way values are embedded in the design of networks and information systems. And so it's really been interesting for me to be part of this Genie effort and the opt-in working group, although for much of the time I feel myself to be more of a learner than anything else, but thus far it's proven very interesting, and I look forward to sitting over here in New Jersey and envying you guys in Florida and hearing what you have to say.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Helen. Henning, are you on? No? No. Okay. With that, I'd like to start the program and invite Matt Mathis to come up and begin his discussion of the requirements of wholesale opt-in.
Good morning. So about half of this is a repeat of the presentation I gave at the last meeting. I'm going to talk a little bit about some stuff I've been doing in terms of opting in a very large number of users. I'm part of a Three Rivers Optical Interchange, which is the ISP in Pittsburgh that supplies connectivity to CMU, University of Pittsburgh, Penn State, and at least research connectivity to University of West Virginia, WVU. And the question that we started approaching is, how could you imagine, we're in a position where if we had the proper policy framework, we could literally intercept essentially all of the traffic in or out of one of those campuses. So the question is, how do we go about, it's sort of not the technical issues, but the policy issues and the framework issues to make this all work. So This is what I'm going to cover sort of real quickly. I'm going to look at the diagram. So we actually, our core is actually a tandem pair of routers in two distinct locations. These boxes are roughly $250,000 apiece, fully populated. The attached campuses, as I mentioned, cover four large universities, and actually most of the K-12 in western Pennsylvania, and a bunch of libraries and stuff like that, and a little bit of commercial traffic. We're connected to two commercial backbones, both Internet 2 and NLR, and various associated services of theirs. We have about 200,000 users. And the direct cost of our service, that is the rate at which we bill out our service, is more than $1 a second. Okay? Downtime means that you can't get to Sightseer or any of the cool resources at CMU, Pitt, or Penn State. So downtime is probably a couple of orders of magnitude more expensive. This is real equipment. It's run like a business, although it's non-profit. So the question is, how can we intercept traffic using something like, using either OpenFlow, or we had originally proposed a thing called Firewall Filter in Juniper, or the equivalent Cisco syntax, to capture some of the traffic flowing through Ruhr's optical exchange and divert it into Genie. And what I will talk about eventually and get around to, and I'm going to sort of come back to it, the real key piece is you need to isolate Genie from the production infrastructure. There needs to be this proxy in between, which I'm calling an ISP daemon, which is where the ISP exerts control over what the experiment can do, and it's sort of the last filter against the Genie doing something to the production infrastructure that we didn't really mean to have happen. The experiment control actually turns out to be sort of need to be decomposed into two separate layers, and the reason is there's what I call a component manager, which looks like other link-like device component managers, or might look like one of them, in the sense that the opt-in looks to Genie like a special type of link that when you turn it on, you magically get traffic from someplace else. The experiment control has to deal with another problem, and that is it's not safe to do opt-in unless the entire slice is assembled. And so there has to be a Genie-wide criteria for determining whether or not the slice itself was ready. And so there's sort of two different pieces of the problem. And I will talk about some of these things in more detail. It would actually be better. My real purpose here is to motivate people to read some of this stuff. So I think I've said all this. A lot of money. Pattern match. Yeah, examples of things you could match. For instance, we could easily match traffic between a specific pair of campuses. We could easily match specific services that are well-bound to ports. We can't do DPI. We could match TOS bytes. The way you would do something like DPI is have a second stage of filtering inside of Genie. So you could divert a large class of traffic through Genie. You could imagine doing some sort of higher level filtering and trying to determine something, identify a protocol on a dynamic port or something like that. So I mentioned that. I'm going to talk a lot more about that later. Two levels, I think I said all of this. So the really hard problem is dealing with a policy and actually getting all of the participants individually to be motivated to do the right thing. You can't build a system like this. You can't imagine getting really large buy-in unless it is in every participant's self-interest to do what you want them to do. And so the easy way to think about this is to look at each of the communities who are participating and what they need to do in order to make it happen. So for Genie, which as a project has a constituents, researchers, they really drive the process, and they're motivated to go through the necessary hoops to get the ducks lined up to make things happen. I guess I should take a step back. How many people here are familiar with the institutional review boards, have dealt with them? So how many people are not familiar with them? Okay, one, two. Okay, Institutional Review Board is a process required by law in the U.S. for evaluating federally funded research. And the goal of the IRB system, which I will talk about more extensively later, is to make sure that you protect the rights of the subjects. And balancing the rights of the subjects against the value of the research. One of the things that researchers have often run into is various kinds of tension in managing the user base. The problem is the researchers really want to change things, and if you're going to draft users to use some cool exotic service, the users really want that service to be stable. And this is a sort of a fundamental tension for certain kinds of services, and it has often led to success disasters where experiments got out of control and became production services that people didn't want where people couldn't continue to do research on them because they became ossified by a user base. So I'm going to give some examples about how this opt-in mechanism can help with that problem. First of all, sort of the really simple case, which is sort of the standard small-scale opt-in, which has been mentioned in several different ways in other settings here. You imagine dropping in a filter which intercepts a particular subnet of traffic and sends it in through Genie, and it runs for a little while, and you turn it off. There can be several different levels of this. Ultimately, the level you would like to support is one where you automatically, where the experiment opts in a block, but individuals can opt out specific machines. And there's a process for doing that both automatically and online. This comes from what the IRB is likely to say over the long term. In the short term, I don't imagine doing it dynamically. So another cool thing that you can do with this is you can actually do alpha and beta testing within a single experiment. And here we get into troubles because, I should say, a single project, where you run essentially two versions of the same experiment, an alpha version and a beta version, and you have a small group of people who are struggling with the alpha version, trying to make it work, and a much larger group of people doing some sort of wholesale opt-in on the beta version, and then at some magic flag day, you swap them back and forth. And depending on the experiment and the protocols used, you can imagine this providing a lot of agility for isolating, for the experiment team to have good control over their interaction with their loyal user base. An easier way of doing this, which is even more graceful if your experimental protocol supports it, you can even steer traffic on the basis of whether or not the version number is odd or even. So you can say all the even version goes to the blue slice and all the odd traffic goes to the green slice. And then just by bumping versions on the desktop, people automatically switch to the right slice, and each user has a window to change versions, which has to do with how long they leave both slices in a useful state. You don't want any users to be more than two versions out of step. Actually, you don't want them to be no more than one version out of step. So this provides a very powerful mechanism for a research team to manage users in sort of the classic experiment ossification to avoid that problem. Another thing that often runs into is weaning users, and I don't know how many people in this room have experienced disasters of this source where you put together a really cool experimental service and you get more opt-in than you really wanted by word of mouth because it's a cool service, and then you go to turn it off and somebody's proposal needs your service or some other major deadline needs your service. So you keep it up for a little bit longer, and then somebody else starts using it, and they become addicted to it. And it can be a real problem occasionally to turn off projects. Again, you can do this by changing from wholesale opt-in to individual opt-in and making people go through hoops to stay involved, like asking them for money even if you want to completely unfund it. So Institutional Review Board. Institutional Review Board is really responsible for looking out for the subjects. And it is explicitly mandated by law that for anything that looks like research that is government funded, that you have some process like this. Now, the interesting thing is, speaking as a, if I put on my operator hat, there are things I can do as an operator without IRB approval as part of normal operations, that if I do the same thing as a researcher, I need to get approval. And so one of the things that is conditional on is the fact that it's funded research, not operational stuff. There are actually two versions of it. It's amazingly easy to read. The CFR Title 45, Part 46, which is the HNSS version of the law, is really straightforward to read. I recommend it for anybody who's going to do anything complicated with an IRB. If you know the law, it will help you. They're less likely to think you're pulling something over on them. The NSF version of the law is essentially identical. The HNSS version of the law, or the rules, specifically suggest that the different agencies adopt their own version. The NSF version is primarily different in formatting. I wasn't actually able to find anything different on it, but because of the formatting differences, the NSF version is a lot harder to read. It doesn't have nice, the hierarchy of the document is sort of lost. In a lot of universities, there are actually two different review processes, depending on whether you're doing social science kinds of questions or biomedical kinds of questions, and they have very different and a lot, they actually have different boards for doing the different experimentation. And I suspect people at these kinds of campuses that are organized this way have been having a lot of troubles using the IRB process for networking research because the boards are really focused on their own agenda and they are naturally very cautious of risk they don't understand. At smaller institutions, there's usually a larger board and they just draft a subset of people to look at individual proposals, and so there's much more blended expertise. My understanding is that people at CMU, for instance, don't particularly have problems with getting reasonable research, what they consider to be reasonable research, to the IRB, although I'm sure people have had all sorts of experiences. One of the comments that I made is, as I read the law, it actually says that the board has to have expertise in the field of endeavor, and if the university doesn't have a board which is capable of supervising networking research, it probably can't legally say no. But I'm not a lawyer. So there's a long list of rules, most of which aren't particularly relevant. There's a special set of rules about prisoners and pregnant babies and pregnant women, but none of those are relevant here. But the rules that we do care about, there's a bunch of rules about informed consent. There's a lot of rules. In fact, a lot of the educational material is about leaking PII, or personal identifiable information. And the whole idea that you need to balance the value of the research against the risks to the subjects. One of the things that comes up is there's a lot of exceptions to some of these things. Informed consent isn't feasible for doing wholesale opt-in. For imagine an experiment involving all of the dorms at CMU, which is sort of one of the models that I use. And the problem is you can't necessarily ask everybody if it's okay. In these cases, there's sort of an alternate protocol, which is giving people notice of a way to avoid the experiment if they choose to, and opting everybody in. There is an example that comes up in the educational material that if you want to do an experiment on the readability of detour signs, getting people's permission doesn't work. One of the things you might think of doing, for instance, is photographing license plates and sending people letters that say, is it all right if we do this, or warning that we're doing this experiment, and if you don't want to participate, go someplace else, use a different road. The problem with that is the process for getting informed consent leaks PII. And it leaks PII because it may be that you don't want somebody at your home address to know that you drove on that particular road in that particular day. So there's a lot of lore and a lot of detail in this stuff, but at the end of the day, it's actually quite rational. One of the other thing that came up is the, at least in the biomedical, most of the emphasis is on shades of ethical issues, especially for high-risk research. If you're doing, you want to do medical procedure on somebody, there's a lot of questions about whether or not the informed consent was really properly informed, whether it was really consent, whether there was coercion. The ethics issues dominate in some of the other fields. In Genie and in the networking field, the big issue is likely to be unanticipated consequences and interactions, and particularly because so many users are always installing their own services. I mean, every time you go to a website that downloads a piece of software, even if it's just an applet that's in the website, you may not know it. You are participating in an experiment, in a sense. And there's not an easy way in the network of determining if something the network is doing is interfering with a particular feature in a particular website. So there's a lot of technical questions dealing with risk, but I think we can deal with that. I'm not a lawyer, but there's been a lot of work lately in trying to devise some ways of collecting packet traces which are the telecom lawyers are happy with. And the real issue there is because they leak PII, or avoiding leaking PII. And my sense is that a more successful procedure would be to get the telecom industry to buy in on the IRB process and actually have the IRB process review not just a particular trace format and a particular anonymization technique, but a particular way of handling the data, a particular way of collecting the data, the entire experiment process. And if you do this, you can also do non-standard things which make it much safer. So for instance, one of the things that used to be considered okay but isn't anymore is doing strong one-way hashes on IP addresses. This, of course, doesn't work because you can invert them pretty easily. However, it might be good enough if you did a strong strong hash on, say, the local address and completely remove the remote address, because then you don't have conversations anymore. And although you can still invert it, the information is much less relevant to anything that anybody cares about in terms of stuff. Now, it may or may not be okay. I don't know. But you can imagine, and that data, of course, isn't useful for a lot of experiments, but it is useful for some experiments. And so you can imagine an IRB saying this process is good enough, and if the IRB says this process is good enough, I find it very unlikely that the telecom legal enforcement is going to care about it. Oops. I lost my slideshow. Running twice. Okay. The other thing is there's a separate section of law, and I don't have the handle here, but it's specifically meant for addressing research involving criminal activity, drug use, crimes and such as that, under the HNSS procedures, where you can create data sets which are in advance protected from subpoena. This makes the data sets unsubpoenable, and there's a fairly complicated process for it. The astonishing thing about the law is, although it was clearly meant for looking, for doing studies on things like drug addiction, the law itself is in fact completely general and could be applied in principle to anything for which there is an IRB process and approval for. The hard part of it is the part of the certification actually has to come from the director of the agency or something like that. But it's an avenue that needs to be explored. Oops. So, the ISP has a broader responsibility. The ISP actually cares about all their users. And if things go wrong at the opt-in, it's quite possible that the harm extends beyond even the people, pool of people considered by the IRB. The ISP ISPs in general are very, very sensitive to complaints from their customers. They know their service is expensive. A lot of customers have very, very strict rules about downtime. They have very, very strict rules about configuration changes. They have very strict procedures for doing anything that they view as risk. And the universities that are connected to us would not take kindly to midday downtime. They don't take kindly to midday downtime. We work very hard to avoid it. So it's critical to the ISP that everything, that all risks are under, well under control. And it's really essential. It turns out that it doesn't make sense for the Genie control plane to touch the core routers directly. There's a number of reasons for it. More and more ISPs are moving to the model where the management network within the ISP is separate from the transit networks. We haven't done this yet at Three Rocks, but we're working on it. And so the issue, the way you think about it, is the routers have internal firewalls such that the management protocols can only talk to the routers on this private network, not on the production network. And that private network, in our case, that private network is almost always non-routed in some way. In our case, we're planning on using Net 10. So we will have Net 10 addresses that we use that in order to manage routers, you need to tunnel into from elsewhere to manage routers. Well, Genie can't talk to those interfaces. It flat out can't. It's also true that because the ISP needs to be able to manage router, when these routers go down, you have no DNS, you have no Kerberos, you have no third-party authentication services, because you have no connectivity. You have to be able to manage these routers using dotted quads and services that are only on the routers. And that means minimal, you know, pre-configured SSH keys, things like that. And so touching the routers directly requires sharing key material, which isn't going to happen directly between Genie and the core routers. And so the solution is you have to have this opt-in, this ISP daemon, which is a proxy between the ISP and Genie. To the first order, it just needs to pass commands back and forth, but the change of responsibility happens between the ISP daemon, the DMARC on the responsibility happens between the ISP daemon and Genie, and the ISP daemon, the ISP has to be able to do things like veto individual experiments, because if they're debugging a problem, even if it's unrelated to Genie, having Genie intercepting traffic as part of an opt-in experiment will complicate the debugging. And in fact, it's clearly the case that if one of the national backbones, if there's a problem in the national infrastructure and people are going, you know, why can't I get to CNN, and they trace route to CNN, you don't want that trace route going through Genie, even if Genie is not the problem. Right? So if there's completely unrelated failures, there's a whole bunch of cases where you just want to turn off experiments because it will cause a lot of questions you don't want to deal with. Also, the ISP is ultimately going to be responsible at some level for enforcing, at least at the coarsest scale, some part of the IRB policies. So, for instance, if an experiment is to opt in a subnet in the computer science department, it's the ISP's responsibility that you don't opt in a subnet in some other university. I mean, at that level, at minimally at that level, it has to be. So, I'm actually going to stop there and take questions. I have an extra copy of this at the end for some reason. Any questions?
Matt, can you? I don't know if you can hear me through the phone.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Sorry, I dropped in late because traffic of the non-network kind interfered, and I couldn't do packet dropping along the way. So,
don't we all wish?
So one question which you may have addressed, which I, when I looked at your document, I have some reasonably close relationship with our local network operations folks, and quite frankly, I have a really hard time imagining what their incentive would be, assuming their value, their job security, to risk the network operation for having a paper published at Infocom? And why would a network operations center cooperate with a researcher on their own campus, let alone on any other campus? And if I were to approach your institution and say, hi, I want to redirect your network traffic because I have a new idea, if you said yes, I would, I would question your sanity.
It's very simple. If the IRB gives me a document that says, you have permission to send all of CMU's traffic through a Mixmaster, I can make it go through Mixmaster. And if CMU doesn't like that, then CMU has to talk to the IRB. They don't have to talk to me, right? There needs to be an absolutely clear delineation of responsibility.
Right, but I mean, if traffic goes places which could interfere with operational mobility as opposed to just copying traffic,
that's why,
but if traffic goes places where it normally would not visit, and if that experiment can interfere with operational stability, why would any sane network operator do that?
That's the issue, is you've got to stack the deck in the ISP's favor so the ISP can avoid doing things that they consider to be risky and can unambiguously pass the buck for things for which it's told to do with proper authorizations, which go wrong. If the IRB says...
If the network operations center says, well, sorry, we have IRB clearance when some other when the physics department calls up and says, why my network isn't working anymore.
Then I would say, just a second.
But that we don't care.
No, my first answer would be, well, let me see if that looks like it's an experiment. That looks like it's an experiment. I'm going to turn the experiment off. Okay, here's the authorized experiment. Here's who you speak to try and get the criteria for the next run to be better. So it doesn't interfere with you.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't understand. Again, it might be helpful to distinguish between different kinds of experiments, but I don't understand why a network center would allow any kind of experiment that had any possibility of interfering with network reliability, IRB or not.
Because ultimately, my job is to deliver the traffic where I'm told, and if the IRB tells me to deliver CMU's traffic to a Mixmaster, I've done that.
The IRB has no, it only allows things. It cannot force you to do things.
IRB doesn't come with a check.
Yeah, but... It
doesn't come with money and funding.
Well, the motivator for that, and this is also sort of buried in the paper, and I ask this question several different ways to various NSF people. NSF can't tell people to opt in. But they can tell people that if there's Genie infrastructure on their campus, they have to participate in the opt-in conversation. And if they choose to not opt in, if they choose to opt out, they have to justify it.
And I mean, that's not going to happen. I mean, frankly, I think it is ridiculous.
Well,
if NSF were to do that, I would find out. I would protest to NSF. I don't see why the physics department, just because Genie,
If NSF is spending eight figures on Genie, NSF certainly can put one paragraph in a whole lot of solicitations.
Okay, let's just say, for the record, I think that's just silly. Okay.
I'd like to move on. Was there another question on the floor here, I guess? More comments?
Jim, did you want to? Okay.
I think from an opt-in point of view, I think this is a very ambitious thing, and I think you've done a great job of putting together something that tries to summarize it.
Yeah.
His document, are you going to formally review that at some point, the requirements document? Because that really lays this out very carefully. And I want
The so-called opt-in requirements document turned out more to be a white paper on what you need to do.
I think we're going to want to discuss that, because I think there's a lot of people that would like to see this happen, and I value Hennig's skepticism. I think we're going to have to balance those things and see what can be done.
Yep.
Can I take your microphone before you run?
Oh, that's probably a good idea. Got to do this all in the right order.
Well, Matt, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.